to leave at 4:30. One of our legislators is ill, and one is late. And one I haven't heard from. But
one's so, coming right there.
Yep, Chair.
Yes, one is coming right here.
I know.
And that's
God bless you.
Yes. And I want to explain what happens is that we all have bills that we're testifying on in other committees. So people come and go. It's not because people aren't interested in what you have to say. We are very interested. But people have to go testify to other committees on bills that they are presenting themselves. So anyway, we'll open. And so if I speed you along, it's because I'd really like for us to be done at 4:30 if possible. So we're going to open up the informational hearing on long-term care. Mike McCormick, and I think you've got a quick video. Is that right?
Chair Tomei, that is correct. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike McCormick. I'm the Deputy Director for Aging and People with Disabilities, and I can't thank you enough for scheduling this hearing. Chair Tomei has asked for an informational presentation on what it's really like at the front line for providers and consumers of long-term care services. And so we put together a good presentation, we hope, for today, and my goal is to say as little as possible. This video, however, does reflect the departmental values and what we're trying to accomplish in our system. It's a very effective video and tells our story quite well, so I'd like to start by showing this.
I love life. I am grateful to be alive.
Norwegian faced many challenges. At 16, she found out that she had a brain disorder. It was 50 years later since she suffered a stroke.
It is all the way up.
Put the microphone down.
Put the microphone close to the speaker.
That is a great idea. Where is the audio coming from?
He checked it.
Do we have any young people in the room?
Define young.
Yeah, right. Under 55.
IT was here. They assured me it was as loud as it would go.
This is, I think, it's okay. So, briefly, this is an individual that resided in a nursing facility for several years, had a great desire to remain independent in her own apartment. Our local office case manager down in the Medford area worked extensively with this individual, set up a great service plan. This individual's name is Noreen. She's very inspiring. She's very happy. She has wonderful quality of life as a result of this successful transition that took place. That's the basics of the story, and that's what we're trying to accomplish with state offices and our Area Agency on Aging Partners, trying to help seniors and people with disabilities live in the most independent setting possible. So that's the basic story of the video. I apologize for the technical difficulties, but I'm sure we won't have any problem filling the remainder of the time. So the next panel member that I'm going to invite up is Jennifer Cook. Jennifer has a father who is suffering from dementia, and her mother is an unpaid caregiver for her father, and Jennifer assists with family caregiving, and she's going to share her experiences with this.
Great. Hello. Feel free to jump in and ask questions at any point. As an aside, my profession is doing placement. I'm a consultant, and I work with families to find the most appropriate living situation when they can no longer stay at home, which is it's a very expensive proposition. So just to paint, I think my parents are actually a very good case study of an average situation, other than they're younger. They're both 72 years old. My dad was diagnosed 6.5 years ago with early dementia, early stages of dementia. It's now full-blown, moderate, to severe. And my mom is his full-time caregiver. She was forced into retirement. He was forced into retirement, so that cut back on their savings capabilities. He had blown, he'd taken out extensive loans prior to the diagnosis, trying to hide the dementia. He had been a very successful real estate agent, but their generation, you don't always ask the business. He was getting up, going to work every day, and not, you know, she never asked or really looked at the balances on things. And he had accumulated roughly $100,000 in additional debt that she did not know about by the time it was discovered. Just physically, my dad is about 6'3", my mom is 5 foot nothing. So when it gets to the point, and he went through a stage where he was falling occasionally, she can't do anything about it. She can't get him up either. So physically, there's a challenge. It's exhausting. The dementia behaviors come in waves. There's no real rhyme or reason to it. He sometimes will get up and wander at night. So at some point when he wanders out, there may be an issue. We moved them into a condominium complex, and she's notified all of their neighbors. So the community knows the scenario that they're under, and she has some immediate support until I can get there. We live roughly 15 minutes apart. It has impacted my abilities. I changed careers. I used to travel 50% of the time, and I am off the road and home so that I can be there to relieve her when she needs help, and she does. There's some great programs out there that are way underfunded to help relieve the family caregivers. Respite programs, daycare, adult daycare, there's very few programs out there. Some of the memory care communities are creating daycare options. They're still really expensive, $75 to $150 a day, private pay. I mean, that's the only option. They participate in one that's about 4 hours a day, 2 days a week, and it's the best value out there. It's through Lake Oswego Adult Community Center, and it's $30 per day. It's very volunteer-oriented. So that's a great program.
That's great. Thank you. So tell us about how many people in Oregon would be in a similar situation to this.
Chair Tomei, I don't know the exact answer, but what I do know is that the Oregon's Medicaid system only supports 3.7% of Oregonians aged 65 and older. We also know for a fact that the vast, vast majority of all long-term care is provided by unpaid family caregivers. This is a very typical story. This is more the rule than the exception in Oregon. And I think as a state, we greatly benefit from family caregivers.
It would be really helpful if at some point we would get some figures about how many people are in this situation, what happens when a family caregiver isn't able to stay with them, or what it costs a family caregiver, not just in terms of finances, but also health.
Yes.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Wisnett.
So can they, your parents, did they essentially have to become destitute or lose all their savings in their home before they would qualify for the Oregon Medicaid long-term care? Can you tell us who qualifies for it, is what I'm asking.
Chair Tomei, Representative Witsit, today the eligibility criteria to access long-term care services is having, and I'm going to summarize, but roughly $2,100 in monthly income or less, less than $5,000 in assets, and have a meet what we call our service priority level or our level of care, which means that an individual demonstrates that they need long-term services and supports.
Okay.
That's the basic eligibility criteria.
And I'm sure we're going to be coming up with more questions.
Of course.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
So the next perspective is equally important and very enlightening. We invited Lori Petullo, who is a case manager from our local area agency on aging here in Salem, Northwest Senior and Disability Services. And Lori's going to share some stories or her perception or experience around assisting individuals who require long-term care.
Hello. Thank you. Again, my name is Lori Petullo. I'm an APD case manager.
And use words and not letters because
okay.
It's hard for us to
adult and physical disability case manager
Thank
for
you.
Northwest Senior and Disability Services.
Great.
I apologize. So I actually can speak to some of the previous questions that you asked. So you asked about being Medicaid eligible for the family caregiver support. They're two different programs. Medicaid is not the same program as the services. I mean, the family caregiver support is not the same services that are provided as services under traditional Medicaid. The qualifications are different for the family caregiver support. I can say from my personal experience that although we have a screening system that when people call in, they talk about kind of what their needs are and what their situation is. So many of the people who would need that family caregiver support are directed to the family caregiver support specialist. But even with that, this is to speak to your question on numbers. Of course, I don't have specific numbers, but I get at least 3 to 4 a month that are directed to me. And again, that's quite significant when you consider we are only actually serving 3%. As far as what I do as a case manager, I really help clients negotiate the systems and programs that we have. So in regards to their particular needs and preferences, and so everybody's different. Everybody's unique, but the people that come to us definitely have a need for care. And I meet with people for the first time, so they haven't had services previously. Often they are clients that are tentative. Maybe they have went through that screening process a couple of times because they want to be independent. They want to, be able to do things for themselves. And sometimes it takes a lot of family prompting for them to come and be able to actually apply for the services. And
what would the services be?
So they're long-term care services. So that can be a variety of things. But I think one of the things that we're talking about is the in-home care services. So being able to receive the care that they need to be able to stay in their own homes and manage. And sometimes that can be something as simple as meal preparation and bathing, but often it's something much more than that. They want to be able to stay in their own home, but they have difficulty being able to use the restroom on their own, and otherwise without someone to help them to get to the restroom, they would not be able to do that. They would soil themselves, in effect. So this is very real stuff. And it's very real stuff, for all of us. Those services would have someone, say, in that situation where they needed assistance to get to the restroom. They would be able to help that person get to the restroom, manage those things, and get back to wherever they were. Sorry.
No.
And so, it's really, really important. We We try to help clients select a plan that's right for them. Sometimes it's in home services, sometimes it's other services like adult foster home, because their need level just requires that, or that's where they might feel most comfortable, where there's 24-hour care available to them. What I try to do is build rapport with them and help determine what the real needs are. Because again, like I said, sometimes clients, they're reluctant. Maybe they're embarrassed about that toileting issue. And so they might not share that need. And so it's my responsibility to kind of help them to be able to share that information so that we can get them the actual needs, that actual services that they need. And I have seen the services. You guys didn't get to see that video, but I have personally got to experience clients that have benefited from the services so much. I have a client that had a stroke about 8 years ago and was paralyzed on one side. Wasn't no longer able to walk and so forth. And she was married, lived with her husband, and it was really tearing them apart to imagine that she would have to go to a facility or go somewhere else, and then he'd be stuck living home alone. He is blind. He's legally blind, and he also has some heart problems, so he was not able to take care of her in their home. And they did not want to be separated, and they were very concerned about that. And we were able to set up in-home services for them. They have two caregivers. They split shifts, and they come in and do all. She's not able to bathe herself or brush her hair or do anything. They come in, and they assist her with all of those needs. And I'm so grateful that that was available to them, and that they were able to stay together in their own home and be able to have her needs looked after.
So who pays for that, and how much would that cost?
In that particular scenario, they have Medicaid services, so Medicaid pays a portion of it. These particular clients also, they, because of their income, there is a rule that clients that make more than the Social Security poverty level, which is only $710 a month, are required to contribute some towards their services. So she contributes all of her income over $710 towards the services, and then the state pays the rest. I believe her services are around, they're between $1,600 and $1,800 a month.
Thank you. Representative Gumberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your good work. Let's go back to the beginning. How do I become a client?
Okay. So we have a website that is called the ADRC, Aging and Disability Resource Center. Sometimes people will be looking for help, and they'll see that, and they'll be able to get information that will allow them to call in other people. It's through word of mouth. Or often maybe something happens, a trigger, like they have to go to the hospital, and the hospital may contact us and let us know that there's a client that has a need. And that's through that screening process that I was talking about. So they'll call into the information and assistance, and they will tell that person, discuss with that person what their kind of their basic needs are and the things that are going on with them, and then it will be assigned to a case manager to contact them and go to their home and meet with them.
Chair Tomei, I've met
numerous people in my life say, I can't wait till the day when I can collect Social Security. I can't wait till the day when I can get Medicare or health insurance. But I have yet to meet a single person who says, I can't wait till the day when I need Medicaid-funded long-term care. This is not a service that's sought after. In April, there was a national study with some very compelling statistics, very easy to remember as well. 70% of people do not believe they will ever need long-term care in their lives. The fact is 70% will need long-term care in their lives. And 70% mistakenly believe that if they needed long-term care, Medicare will pay for it. So there's a big public education component around this that's needed to, you know, just inform the public around, you know, the cost of long-term care, the need for financial planning, et cetera.
Thank you, Mike.
Mr.
Yes, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McCormick, I'm well aware of the situation from family involvement and things like that. I was surprised Mrs. Cook said that her, I thought the family member can receive some pay for helping with a spouse or something like that is in the home. And can you, I hate numbers, I mean we should be, we're talking about people, but what percentage able today are able to pay for their long-term health care themselves with insurance? And that's what we really need to be working for. I wanted to require all state employees to pay for health, long-term health care. And do you think that that's, people are doing that, or are they still hoping that the Medicare, Medicaid is going to take care of them?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, we know that the penetration of long-term care insurance is very low. Very few Oregonians access that insurance for a variety of reasons. So the answer is that there is not, I don't believe that there is good planning by the general public for this potential need.
State employees could set the example by doing it. Because what you're saying is you're only taking care of 4% or 3%. So the rest of people either aren't being taken care of, but what do you think? Do you think it's 10%, 20% have long-term health care insurance?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, no. I believe that those that have long-term care insurance is much lower. I think it's under 5%. The majority of long-term care is unpaid care provided by family members. That is the backbone of long-term care delivery.
And Madam Chair, I don't know if the committee, all the committee knows, but in Oregon, we passed a bill to give you a tax credit, not deduction, a tax credit for long-term health, personal long-term health care. And I think that's going to be studied by the tax credit committee. It's going to be looking at it. But it's a significant amount. I think it's like I get 1 month free for my long-term health care policy that I pay for. So.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair. I'm curious if you have any trend data. We've been hearing for years about the retirement of the baby boom generation and so on. And I know a lot of, we're living longer, so inevitably then we're getting more people who are living past 85 and therefore needing long-term care. We've also got adult families with parents who are now needing more care, and so the burden is on them. So I'm just concerned, one, the numbers of people who are aging and will or do need long-term care, plus the concern for the caretakers, both the family caretakers as well as the paid caretakers that we have, the workers who do the home health care and other kinds of things. So, it's a whole system that we need to really maintain. And as I said, I'm just curious about the projections in terms of need as we go down the next 5, 10, 15 years.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, that's an excellent question. What we are seeing today are relatively flat caseloads for long-term care. But what we are seeing is an explosion of seniors in poverty that was caused by
the prevailing theory is the great loss of wealth associated with the Great Recession.
Mm-hmm.
So more seniors in poverty coming to the state asking for financial assistance helps with their Medicare premiums, help with supplemental nutrition benefits. The need for long-term care has not grown yet. We think that that is on the horizon. We don't think it's a crisis that we need to solve tomorrow. We know it's coming. We are planning for it. And there's actually a bill, Senate Bill 21, that's going that tries to tackle that problem in a responsible manner that will ultimately benefit Oregonians as well as the taxpayers. So that is what we see currently.
Thank you, Mike. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, ladies, in the back. We'll call on you over time. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Lori. Next, I have David Fuchs, who's going to be talking to all of you. I find David one of the wisest people I speak to in this profession, in this job of mine. David has a tremendous amount of experience, a lot of stories in this area, and what I've asked David to focus on today are some real life examples around how a little bit of help can go a long way in keeping people independent, and also about an innovative pilot that he's trying to pilot up in the Portland area. I also know that David may or may not follow my request, so this shall be an enjoyable presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you for that delightful introduction. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Fuchs. I'm Chief Executive Officer of Cedars-Sinai Park, which is an organization that's been providing services to elders and people with disabilities in the Portland metro area since 1920. I'm also a member of the Oregon Medicaid Long-Term Care Quality and Reimbursement Advisory Council, and very pleased to have been participating in that volunteer work on behalf of the state for over 10 years, and I'm also proud to be the legislative chair of Leading Age Oregon, which is the not-for-profit association of providers. Let me tell you about a specific person. I'm going to change her name, but this is a real person. I'm going to call her Lena. Lena's 93 years old. She lives in one of the buildings that we own downtown. We happen to own four Section 8 affordable housing apartment buildings for elders and people with disabilities, with 540 apartments, about 570 residents. Lena lives in the Roschnitzer Tower, which is our largest building, and is 93 years old. She received an eviction notice from the landlord because her apartment was out of control, messy. And we happen to own the building, and I had a social work student assigned to the building, and I said, I want you to go in there and see what you can do to help this lady. Here's what we found. Lena is in sort of the early to middle stages of dementia. She has some memory problems. It's hard for her to organize cleaning her apartment. It's just difficult. At 93, she's fragile. She's got difficulty doing that. She has difficulty remembering how to organize her medications and manage her medications. She hadn't been to the doctor for well over a year. It's a struggle for her to get to the doctor, and let alone to make the appointment. Her phone had been turned off because she was having trouble managing to pay her bills. Not because she didn't have the money to pay the phone bill, but because she didn't have the cognitive wherewithal to put those things together. The student came to me and she said, you know, the service coordinator in the building is a really terrific person, but he's trying to connect her with services, but she has trouble doing that. What should I do? I said, you have the nerve to stand up and help this person. That's what you should do. You get in there and you know, if she needs help cleaning her apartment, you know, don't pretend you're a professional and you don't do that. Help clean the apartment, for God's sake. Get in there and do that. If she needs a doctor appointment, call a doctor. Help her and help her get there. Do the things that she needs to do that will make a little bit of a difference for her. I met this woman with that student, and I can tell you that there are things going on that are very small things that are making a big difference in this little old lady's life. And because of this student's intervention, she's going to be she's turning it around. The eviction notice is being pulled back, she's beginning to move forward in terms of being able to pull her life together. There are lots of Lenas in affordable housing. There are lots of them. In fact, if you take a look at the data I provided you with, when we bought our affordable housing buildings, we did a formal needs assessment. What our needs assessment showed us is that this is a population which is both high Medicare and Medicaid eligibility, that's called dual eligibles. Frequently, they are users of hospitals and emergency rooms and other high-cost services, and at risk of premature or unnecessary nursing home placement. These are the frequent flyers who might come into the hospital because they haven't been to the doctor, and they'll come to an emergency room for a routine health matter because that's the way into health care for them, which is an awfully expensive way to be receiving health care services. These are also the folks that struggle to be compliant with the medication requirements or the rehab requirements that they might have post-hospitalization, so they're the most vulnerable population for going back into the hospital as a result of their care needs. Some of the preliminary data we got from doing needs assessments, and we had Portland State University's Graduate School of Social Work and then the Gerontology Program do formal needs assessments that were funded as a result of grants that we were able to pull in. And what they found is many residents are in need of mental health and substance abuse treatment as well in order to mitigate risk of involvement in the criminal justice system on top of their health care concerns. As you know, an unresponded to mental health problem or unresponded to substance abuse problem frequently brings somebody to the attention of law enforcement. And I have to tell you, I have an enormous regard for people in law enforcement. You know, it's my first job as a social worker. I was doing juvenile justice diversion. I used to ride along with the police at least once a month. And these are people that put their lives on the line for us. But they are not trained mental health professionals. We can't, you know, it's unfair to expect them to be trained mental health professionals. But the encounter frequently results, if somebody has a mental illness problem or a substance abuse problem, in people finding themselves in trouble in the justice system. These kinds of things and the issues that lead to repeat hospitalizations and nursing home placements result in people losing their apartments. We took a look at the national data about this population also, and here's what we learned, is that elders in affordable housing are four times more likely to need help with activities of daily living, getting dressed, bathing, taking your medications, going to the bathroom, cooking, providing yourself with food, four times more likely to need help with those kinds of things than people living in their own homes of the same age, and twice as likely as people of the same age living in their own apartments where they're paying rent. This is an impact, the impact of poverty. That's what we're looking at here. But the fact is, you know, if you think about what was being done for Lena, it's a lot of little stuff that makes a difference for people. I learned this as a son. You know, I got to be a family caregiver myself. There's no exemptions to that kind of responsibility. How lucky can we be, actually, to live in an era where life expectancy is so high and we get to have our parents so late in our lives and the honor of being able to take care of them if we can. And I have to tell you that, you know, both my parents are gone now, but what a privilege it was for me to be able to fly back to their condo and spend time with them and do simple things like change the light bulb in the refrigerator. My dad was impressed that I figured out how to do that finally. And to be able to do those small things makes all the difference in the world for people to be able to stay at home and to be successful. But again, a lot of the folks in affordable and subsidized housing don't have those kinds of resources. So if you turn the page, you'll see a graphic that describes the project that we're trying to develop as a housing with services model. The idea is to link healthcare and social services with affordable housing, because these are the hot spots where the greatest number of frequent flyers among elders and people with disabilities are living. At the bottom of this, you see a red line that says tenant empowerment and involvement. I would never want to create a service system that was simply based on my own fantasies or feelings about what are the right things to do. Our goal is to engage the tenants, who are an enormously diverse and rich population of interesting people, in the process of helping us to make the best decisions about what are the right services to provide. Because we need to do those things that people want and that people need as much as we possibly can. We are pulling together a service provider consortium made up of home care providers, mental health providers, health care, substance abuse treatment, and people capable of case management. Besides our own organization, we have Central City Concern involved with us, Cascadia and LifeWorks Mental Health, Sinai Family Home Services, which is a home care entity which we have a small interest in, and the Asian Health and Family Center, which because we have a very large Asian population in our buildings, and we wanted to make sure to engage them. And we are reaching out to other populations. I had breakfast this week with the director of Islamic Social Services of Oregon, and we were talking about how, you know, we have a significant Farsi-speaking population, and I need somebody who I can engage in this project who is able to speak Farsi with these Persian expatriates. These are folks who came to the U.S. after the Shah fell, and now they're old, and they need some help. And so what we're looking for is, how do we bring in that team of people across cultures that can help to provide services?
David, how many people will be in this program?
There are 570 residents in our four buildings. Home Forward, which is the Housing Authority of Portland, has asked to be a participant in the initial phase of this project. They will bring our number, because, and they are located also. All four of these buildings are within a 5-minute walk of each other. Home Forward has three other buildings within that 5-minute walk. It will bring our numbers up to 1,000. Our goal is to implement this project with these 1,000 people, and incidentally, the CCOs in Multnomah County are engaged in this process, as is Care Oregon. They want to see this happen. This is happening as a result of the cooperation of the state, and they included us in a CMMI innovation grant, which we're very grateful that we'll be receiving. We brought in grants from the Weinberg Foundation out of Baltimore, Maryland, and are applying to the Hedco Foundation out of California to get money to convert a commercial space in one of these buildings into a health and social services clinic, and we are working with the CCOs to develop a per member per month model, modeled something along the lines of an employee assistance program. This is not long-term care, it's home and community-based services to try and help people. But if we use a per member per month model to be able to provide a couple of hours a month of access to home care, so you have somebody who can come into your apartment maybe once a week for a half an hour to set up your meds, or maybe once a month come in and help clean up a little bit. Contact with a community health nurse that floats around the buildings. A few hours of mental health services available to you, so that when you're under stress or you're struggling, or when your family is struggling with how to be able to take care of you, because it is tough on families, that there's somebody to talk to, and a group of providers co-locating in this clinic space that can make access to health care services is easy. Our feeling is that we are going to have the capacity to be able to do something that will be remarkable. Portland State University will receive some of the grant funds that the state was able to get on behalf of this project to evaluate the project. Our goal is to do a pilot over a 3-year period, evaluate it at midpoint and evaluate it at endpoint, and then put it forward as a model to be replicated across the state. We are one of, Oregon is one of 11 states with 12 providers providers that are participating in a national collaborative around affordable housing with services to be able to have an impact on this kind of a problem and to see what we can do to prevent the need for people to fall over the cliff and need to enter a nursing home or to have unnecessary repeated hospitalizations. If somebody needs to be in a nursing home, great. You know, I'm in that business too. But we cannot be in the business of putting behinds in beds. We need to be in the business of empowering elders and helping them to live successfully in our community and to change the way our organizations work and our systems work. And I'm proud to tell you that I'm not alone among the not-for-profit providers who want to do this. Our goal is to collaborate with the state and to develop a model. And I cannot even begin to describe to you the reputation of Oregon when I go to D.C. and into this kind of a collaborative around the kind of creativity that our state puts forward to be able to make this happen. To have this project embraced by Aaron Kelly Seal and Dr. Goldberg and the governor's office has made a tremendous difference to us. Our goal is to try and figure out how to use an entrepreneurial, creative business model to do something, to provide services to people where it's less costly to provide them service and it helps them to stay at home. And for those that need more intensive care, to at least to know that we've done everything possible first so that we're not misusing those dollars or that we're not creating the self-fulfilling institutionalization that comes from not paying attention to the little stuff and then people falling over the cliff and not being able to survive in their apartments and having to live in an institution.
David, when will this be opening up?
We are in the planning phases. We expect that services will begin to be provided in the second quarter of 2014, and then it'll be an ongoing project for the next 3 years.
Great. Any questions of Mr. Fuchs? Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. David, I just want to thank you for your advocacy for your many years of service to this population. You're an inspiration, and we appreciate your work. I do have a question. What do you think about, you know, the question I asked earlier? With the explosion, as it was called, and with this dependent population, how do you suggest we position ourselves to address the needs that are going to be coming? I guess, are there any, you talk about some entrepreneurial kinds of ideas and so on, are there some ideas that you have that could...
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos. I think the demand level is going to be enormous in the next 20 years. We know this to be the case. The average baby boomer across the U.S. has saved somewhere between $50,000 and $200,000 for their retirement, which really, it's nothing. You know, all you have to do is get really sick once. And it's gone. So the level of demand is going to be enormous. But we need to be able to do, and but I can tell you something else about baby boomers since I happen to be one. We're not that cooperative. you know, if you try and develop an institutional solution, we're bust up the institutions. We're not going to behave well in that regard. So what we have to do is create a variety of choices, and a lot of it has to happen at the community-based level. How can we help people to work for as long as they possibly can, because a lot of people are going to need to do that by virtue of their economics and also their desire and the self-image that comes from working. How do we create that kind of capability? How do we create elder-friendly communities that make it possible for people that are slowing down a little bit to be able to manage their way around? How can we promote the development of new kinds of affordable housing beyond the Section 8 program? What else can we do to be creative in terms of how we use the relationship between housing and community services and the Departments of Human Services and the Health Authority to create services that will allow people to be self-sustaining and to live with dignity? These are absolutely possible things to do. And the other thing we need to recognize is we absolutely have to support family caregivers, because it's correct, 95% of people are going to receive care from within their own family. And I have to, having been a family caregiver, I can tell you it's enormously challenging, and it's particularly challenging for spousal caregivers. The Journal of the American Medical Association 12 years ago published a report focusing on family caregivers, and what they showed was a remarkably shorter lifespan for spouses who do caregiving than for people who receive help with caregiving. And it's, you know, and the reason for that is very clear. It's the stress. What's really interesting about that is in married couples, married men live longer, and married women live shorter. And it speaks to the same thing. Although I have cited that statistic in my locker room in one of the fellows, said, no, it just feels longer. but the reality is we men benefit from the good offices of the women who we live with. But the women who take care of us do not benefit from taking care of us, and we've got to create that support and education and a model of support. One of the things that's amazing to me is in Medicare and Medicaid, and I spent 24 years working with children before I started working with elders. When you work with kids, even in the Medicaid program, there are funds set aside to provide family therapy and social services. That's how you and I met, Representative, was in that world.
That's right.
And it makes a tremendous difference. And yet, when we're dealing with elders, the identified patient gets the Medicare and the Medicaid supported services, and there's no funding for services to provide the health care and the social service support and the mental health care that family members need. And that respite could make a tremendous difference. I think perhaps the most creative thing that I could recommend to the state is let's put energy into educating family caregivers and providing mental health and social service support to those caregivers while they're under the stress of doing that. Because
David, we need to move on.
All right, okay.
We're going to have one committee hearing, and we're just going to have you, David.
I'd be glad to respond to your questions until you send me away.
Yes,
all right,
so
thank you.
Is your email address on here, David? I'm not sure that
I think I have a pocket full of business cards.
I'll leave those with the staff so people can get to you. And I think we might want to take a tour of these services.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Next year, when this opens, that would be terrific.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, David. Chair Tomei, I'd like to invite up to the table Clarice, who is a consumer of long-term care. She's going to talk about, I believe, the journey around the intensity of her needs and what long-term services and supports means to her personally.
Great. And maybe if Helen could make her way up here too, then we'll be able to hear from a couple of people pretty quickly. Thank you so much for coming, Clarice.
Thank you. I'd like to put this over on the side. Over here.
Yes. I don't sit down, I just fall down. Good afternoon. Clarice Lauer.
Thank you.
And I've been receiving services since I lived in Tigard in Washington County, and they called it OPI, Oregon Project Independence. And I believe that I first received services after a major surgery. I didn't have any major surgeries until I turned 70, and now I've had a bunch. But I don't know who arranged it for me. I was in a rehab center for a while, and before they let you home from there, they come into your house and see that your furniture and so forth is all moved around so that you can get through with a walker. And I think that those are the people who turned me on to OPI. I'm a retired musician, And at that time, my sole income was my piano teaching. And after every surgery, as soon as I could, I pushed myself up out of bed and into the front room and went back to work. And so when I first got services, I was able to pay for them because I had an income. And the payment is on a sliding scale. And so in the spring of 2007, when the economy tanked, I lost a third of my clientele to out-of-state job transfers, and then I lost even a few more local who people lost their jobs. I'm a luxury in people's lives, and so I lost students then, and the only enrollment I ever had after that was from the families that I already had. I had no enrollment from new families, and in the meantime, my rent's going up and my income's going down. And so my payment to OPI began to be reduced, and I had more surgeries, and so my needs rose, and they met those. They increased my hours and so forth. But when that happened, seeing the handwriting on the walls, I decided I better look for a housing voucher because I was no spring chick at that time. I don't remember how old I was, maybe 73 or 4, I don't remember. But anyway, the waiting list for getting a housing voucher in Washington County was 4.5 years. It was closed in Lane County and Multnomah County. Clackamas County was 4.5 years waiting, and they advised me to just apply all over the state and take the first one I could get.
I think so.
Well, the first one I could get came 3 years later from the Salem Housing Authority. So then I had to make a move. And it came down to the wire. In order to survive on the limited income, I went through my savings account, my tax savings account. I had some silver and gold that I sold. And I had no more resources except my limited income. And the Salem Housing Authority came through just at the right time. And I was reminded at the time of a pastor I used to work for. He had some kind of a play card on his desk that said, sometimes the Lord pulls an 1159. Well, the Lord pulled an 1159 because I could not have survived a minute longer than I did there. I was 76 years old and had to quit working on April 30th of 2010. And my family helped me. I made the move here to Salem. And I've had continued physical problems since then. And right now I'm in a position of being unable to drive or pedal a piano. My right leg has a lot of pain in it, and I haven't had any treatment yet. But the journey from being able to help myself to getting down to where I need more and more in-home help, and the last time I asked Northwest Senior Services for more hours, well, they came out and interviewed me and gave me a few more hours, and then they indicated that the next step was assisted living, because I just was needing too much more help. So I'm on the waiting list at the Orchard House in Mount Angel, and whenever that'll come up, I'll need to make another move. But this is how I'm surviving at this time. I'd like to address Representative Wisnant's comments about long-term care insurance. That is only useful to people who own property and own their homes, so that if they do have long care insurance, the insurance protects them from losing their home and their property. Now, someone sold me long-term insurance one time when I was living in an apartment. I didn't own anything, and I went for it because I thought, you know, that I could have some in-home care there in my apartment. Well, I couldn't. I paid premiums on this for several years, and they couldn't help me in my home. So then I, you know, went to more responsible people in the company, Bankers Life and Casualty, and this guy was way out of line to sell insurance to me, who had no home and no property. So there's a lot of things. I don't know why only 5%. If I had a home and property, I would have paid. It would have been useful to pay the premiums on it. But I don't know if that's my whole story or not, but it's coming close. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Clarice, you're going to be moving to Mount Angel, so how will that be funded?
I qualify for Medicaid, and Mount Angel will accept Medicaid. Most of the assisted living facilities do not. And how that works is it costs about $3,500 a month in an assisted living, and if you've got the money, you pay it. And when you run out of money, you don't pay it anymore. And in my case, my Social Security is only $733 a month, and they will take that and leave me with $153 a month, and that's to pay for extras like television and internet and things like the beauty salon. So it doesn't, $153 isn't going to go very far, but at least they'll take care of me and keep me in nice surroundings. My daughter took me to visit there, and there were 3 pianos and 2 organs on the so I think that I can keep myself quite busy, handicapped or not, and I can have a piano in my apartment, too, an acoustic piano. So I was very pleased with what I learned there.
They will be lucky to have you, Clarice.
Oh, well, thank you.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Clarice, for coming here and telling your story. And I can't help but ask whether you ever got the premiums returned from your long-term care insurance.
But you can believe, and you can say I'm a talker, I really raised a stink in there. And I think that agent, I think he lost his job. And he pulled other stuff like that on people, and the people who were in charge of Bankers Life in here, they knew that. And when I came in there, they realized how wrong he was to sell insurance to me living in an apartment.
Yeah. Representative,
what is the cost per month typically for a long-term health insurance policy?
Well,
your premium.
It's like any kind of insurance. You pay different amounts of premiums for a different amount of return of what the policy is. And I think I paid something like $31 a month for I don't remember how long. I had about $1,600 into it when I realized it was gone. It was a complete loss, but it works like any insurance.
We'll try to find somebody to come and give
That'd
us that information.
Yes.
I think it varies according to your age, et cetera.
Yeah.
Any other questions for Clarice? We will hear from your caregiver. That would be great.
Hello, my name is Helen Cryer, and I am
Stay there, Clarice. We might have more questions for you.
All right,
stay
that's
right
fine.
There.
Okay. I am the clinical manager of the new Edward F. Torkarski home that's owned by Willamette Valley Hospice, and we are an adult foster home level 3 that takes hospice patients, patients into our home and we have a 5-bed unit. Before that, I had my own home for 12 years where we took 2 to 3 people in at end of life that lived with us at that time. I was asked today to come and provide you with some of the stories and experiences that we had in our home. One of the ones that came to mind right away was a resident that came to the new home by the name of John. He was 59 when he came. He was had been on hospice 2 years prior to this and had been discharged because he got better. He had a hospice diagnosis of congestive heart failure, and that's kind of a hard one to sometimes determine terminal prognosis with, and he improved and was discharged. And at that time, we did not have a transitions program, so he kind of fell between the cracks. And so he came to us because he was found on the street. He had fallen, and apparently had fallen several times. And he was back into major congestive heart failure and went into the hospital. And so when he came to us, I thought, this man's not going to have diabetes, and he had weighed 253 pounds, but the majority of that is he was very edematous. Just his legs were swollen and weeping, and he had these terrible wounds on his feet because it just looked like when he took his socks or shoes off that it just took the skin off with it. And I thought, these are never going to heal. He's diabetic, you know, and he's not going to be that long. And at that time, he couldn't even help turn himself. And he, with the medications that they were able to provide for him and stuff, the increase in his Lasix and stuff, we were able to pull a lot of that. We pulled over 50 pounds of fluid off of him. And as that came off, and we dressed his feet daily and did all these things for him, he started to improve. He had a mentality, that's the other part of this, is that he had a mentality of an 8-year-old. He had experienced a shaken baby syndrome when he was 18 months because he had an ear infection in it. And it made his father angry. And apparently he and his two sisters were very much abused in their growing up time. He had a sister who was a retired nurse in California and another one who lived in Springfield, but she was experiencing a lot of depression because of her history of abuse as well. So he really didn't have any family. He didn't have many friends. His friends were the people at Denny's where he ate and the people at Fred Meyer's. And so when he came into the home, he was very distrusting. He didn't want anyone handling him and stuff. So he would only let me do his dressings. He would let the caregivers come in to help him with his bath. But I had to come in when they were doing the end part of it, the private pay, because he didn't trust anyone. But he slowly started to develop trust in the staff there and in the hospice team that came in. And he improved to the point where he was able to turn. We tried sitting him up on the side of the bed and tried to get him up, but when he did, he would lose too much of his heart just was too weak that he couldn't handle that. So he was bedbound, but he stayed with us. He was there for almost 4 months. But his birthday came around in June, and his appetite had improved, and he was eating everything because part of the home was we give you what you want when you want it kind of thing. Well, we had to draw some limits with him because he started to improve so well that he just cake and pudding and ice cream and all those things all the time. But also, and he liked steak and he liked things. And he was great fun. And we became his family. But he kept talking about his sister who had come from California when he first got there because she applied for guardianship for him so that she could take control of some of his stuff so that someone would be over him and help make decisions. And so that he had his birthday, and he kept saying she was coming back for his birthday, and so I just assumed she was all this time. And about a week before his birthday, I thought, I think we need to call her and see, because I hadn't heard her say that she was coming, and he was just so excited about it. And so we called, and I called so he could talk to her one day, and she said, John, I can't come. I can't afford to come there. I never told you I was coming for your birthday. He was devastated, just devastated. And so we were able to, so what I did then the night before his birthday is that, or the day before is that we had found out that his favorite dessert was apple pie. So one of the caregivers baked him 2 apple pies. We'd invited the whole hospice team and everybody that knew him and his volunteer and everybody in. And, a couple of things that he wanted was a cup with his name on it. And so we were able to provide him with gifts and things like that and had a surprise birthday party on Friday for him. And he was just delighted. I mean, just brought him little simple things. But it was amazing. And after that, he said it was the best birthday he had ever had. And he lived for 2 more weeks and then had a heart attack and died. Mm. But it was just an incredible experience. Nice. And
that's very moving.
Mm-hmm. And we have lots of stories like that.
I'm sure you do. And we have other people here to tell their stories. So we really appreciate you coming and telling it. Appreciate the work you do. And Clarice, best of luck to you. And thank you for sharing
your
story.
Thank
you very much. So we're going to have another panel for long-term care experiences. And I know Mike Burdick has to leave pretty soon. Is Mike here?
Yes.
Okay, great. And then we also have Roxanne Hazen, who is a caregiver and a resident. Mike, come on up, please. Go ahead.
A couple of our residents that we came with us. So
okay,
terrific.
They'll
join us.
While they're walking, why don't you tell us who you are and you can just start right talking.
Absolutely.
And just say your name first, please.
Okay. My name is Michael Burdick. I am the executive director for Redwood Heights Assisted Living here in South Salem. I have been with Redwood Heights for over 6 years, and I've been in the industry now for over 8 years, collectively. Redwood Heights is part of the, what we term in the industry as part of community-based care, and gives options for seniors as far as a living arrangement that offers assistance with activities of daily living. But we do differ quite a bit from the different options that are out there, and I think that it's kind of a nice to make that differentiation. In Oregon, community-based care encompasses different options such as adult foster home, where you have a small residential home with about 5 clients per household. They certainly serve a great purpose with a smaller environment. Of course, we have the retirement communities that are more of the living circumstance and less services or no services for folks that have dependents for our needs. And then, of course, you have the assisted living or residential care facilities that are licensed through the Department of Human Services. They can also specialize in memory care. You have memory care units that are freestanding that specialize in advanced dementia care cases. And then, of course, we finish that spectrum off with the nursing home components of skilled nursing, or ICF, which is the long-term component. Adult foster, or excuse me, assisted living, we provide 24 hours staff assistance for any type of assistance needs of daily living, from dressing assistance to showering to meals, housekeeping activities, but we can also do a health care component in the help of medication management, diabetes management, things of that nature, where you may not be able to receive that in another environment, yet we're a whole lot more cost effective than the skilled nursing or nursing home ICF side. So I think it's pretty clear that we've shown in Oregon that the assisted living residential care facility section of the community-based care market really fits a unique clientele, where we have residents that can and do participate in their care. They direct their care. They work really well with us, and I have the opportunity here to introduce you to a couple of the finest ladies that work with me. Just a real quick on Redwood Heights, the community opened in 1997. We have 80 apartments because we are an apartment-style community. We're licensed to a total capacity of 95 residents, but right now we are currently occupied at 78 residents. We have 16 gentlemen and 62 ladies, so the scale's not quite even. We have 6 married couples that live with us, and our average age is 86 years of age. That is our average age. Redwood Heights' mission pretty much falls in line a lot with the state of Oregon's model, and that is to provide the home-like environment with the assistance necessary that preserves the 3 key elements that the state model is shooting for, and that's residents' right to choice, dignity, and, of course, independence. So as we talk with new prospects, we're always telling them that we're not here to do things for you. We're here to help you take care of yourself. And that's how we try to integrate the staff in with the resident care component. Redwood Heights does continue to and has maintained a contract with the Department of Human Services for benefits to residents when they do run out of financial resources. These are the state-run programs, as we all know, run through the CMS Medicaid component. Currently, 38% of our population has state benefits through the Medicaid component. And the nice thing about our community is you wouldn't know looking from one resident to the next who that is. We don't and not allowed to segregate into different sections of the community or anything of that nature. The Medicaid component is incredibly important. I think you'll hear from these ladies because it is a very good program. It does help folks stay in place and age in place. But there is certainly the challenges that go with the cost of taking care of folks, how much federal dollars and things of that nature. I can give you an example of acuity, which is what we use, the term that we use to describe the need level of our community. The number doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot, but the way we score in our computerized system to come up with an acuity of our community. 4 years ago, we were running in the low 5,000 as far as a point total, 5,100, 5,200. Today, with 78 residents, we're running over 7,000 points of scheduled services, which really indicates a 40% increase in the overall acuity of our residents. Most of that is attributed to the fact that our residents are living longer and doing much better, and so they're staying longer in our environment than the national average. And, of course, as we age, our needs increase, so obviously the acuity goes with that. I have noticed over the years that we're seeing fewer and fewer independent residents come join our communities. 3-4 years ago, a lot of folks were thinking ahead and joined the community before they truly had a marked event or a marked need that kind of forced their hand. They were all thinking ahead, budgeting out their pensions and so forth. And we're seeing that today the trend seems to be that residents are holding out in their homes a little bit more, a little longer. They're waiting a little bit more and pushing that envelope just a little farther than they probably safely should. And so, of course, they're entering the community pretty much already behind the eight ball. There is certainly an influx of need for more and more Medicaid beds or rooms available for folks. I think there's pretty well demonstrated that there's more applicants than there are rooms to house them, and that's kind of a shame in and of itself. A lot of the reason is that the not every community has a contract, and not every community is required, but
we'd like to contract with Medicaid.
With Medicaid, yes. So we would like to see that, you know, a stabilized system that would encourage more of the communities to open up and re-enter into the program. Some communities are going on what they call voluntary withdrawal, which means they're closing out their contract over time for whatever reason that they have with the way the state system works. It is challenging to run our community well and keep things going with the way the state reimbursement levels are, but they are what they are. And we need to keep a good, healthy ratio of the private pay sector with the Medicaid component so that when people do spend down, we just convert them over and continue on as if we just had some paperwork to do. But as a business, we have to constantly watch that ratio. And I think that that also is why there is so much more of a demand or for the availability than there is as far as on a supply end, if that made any sense. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the system isn't perfect, but I don't think there is a system that is. What Oregon is and what we know about Oregon's system for community-based care is it is a nationally recognized leader in this field. There are some states to this date, which surprise me, don't even have a system. And Oregon has been in the forefront for decades, and that needs to continue. A lot is being made about the changes in health care. With the Obama legislation, Oregon has come on board with that, and with the Oregon Health Authority's functions, they're creating what's called CCOs, or continuing care organizations, which is a branch of folks that will try and look at the healthcare overall and the individual as an overall whole. Originally, when they started last year, community-based care was kind of left off to the side. We were well enough taken care of, didn't want to bite off that one and get too far involved in the CCO setup. But the Oregon Health Authority has started the committee, and they're starting to answer questions to Medicare on how in the future to integrate community-based care into this CCO component. And having us as part of that collaboration of different entities for the overall benefit of the resident. And so even though we are faced with a lot of challenges now and in the short term, I do want to share a quick story before I turn the microphone over to our better guests.
Mike, we have so many other people here to speak, and I'm afraid we can't take the time for your quick story, but thank you so far for your presentation.
Let me introduce to you, this is Jean Stevenson. She is our Redwood Heights Resident Council President. And this is Council Member Dorothy Gordon. They are both residents with Redwood Heights, and I'll let them have the microphone.
Great. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. I really don't know what I'm here for today, so you'll have to tell me.
Tell me your name first.
Jean Stevenson.
Thank you, Jean. So you're a resident at this facility?
Yes, I moved here from Yuma, Arizona.
Why did you move to Oregon?
Well, mainly because my kids live here, and they didn't want me down in Yuma by myself.
And how long have you been here?
Not quite 2 years.
Okay. Mm.
And I lived in Yuma for 21 years.
So do you miss the sun?
Do I miss the sun? That's a foolish question.
Hey, all right. I got to go.
Not the first one he's asked, Madam Chair.
Hey, all right, time out.
I didn't know what arthritis was in Yuma, and I've had nothing. Oh. Well, in fact, I've got a walker now, which I didn't have.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because my arthritis has acted up because of this wet, cold weather.
Mm. Yeah.
And I didn't know what it was in Arizona.
Mm. Wow. Tell us what your experience is like here in Redwood Heights.
Well, mostly it's been good. I'm very unhappy with our food, but other than that, the other rest of our things that are going on are great. They've got activities. They take us in the bus to special places, and we even got to go to the coast last year, and that was wonderful. So it mostly is a good experience, and I'm not sorry I'm here.
I'm glad. Do we have any questions of this lovely woman? All right. Thank you so much for coming, and we hope to see you more later.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Would you like to tell us about yourself?
Let me see if I can get this up. Not too close.
Do you want to say anything?
Well, actually, why don't you go ahead and let them know about how long you've been there and what you think of the community. Let's start there.
And first, tell us your name.
Dorothy Gordon.
Thank you, Dorothy.
And I, on April 8th, I celebrated my 5th anniversary at Redwood Heights. And time has gone by swiftly. It doesn't seem possible that I could be there 5 years. Mike asked me if I would talk about what has happened to me since I've been there in regard to trying to get on Medicaid. I had a stroke before I came in, and we thought that maybe that would enable me to get on Medicaid, but they said no, I wasn't ill enough. They said if I was falling, I could get on Medicaid. But I've been there 5 years, and I haven't fallen yet.
Okay.
So, since then I have applied, isn't it three times?
Three times total.
Yeah. One time I had 15 points but needed 17 points. I've had a stroke affecting being able to bring my hand up to my mouth, but it didn't last very long, and I believe I returned to Redwood that night after some tests. Had some bleeding on June 10th, 2011, and I had two pints of a transfusion. and was in the hospital for a short time. Recently, about a year ago this past year, I have been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease and also asthma. I'm taking meds for both, and it's kind of expensive. The Advair is $45 for 45 days. And with my Parkinson's, I have a tremor of my right hand and around my mouth, and my teeth chatter. And memory seems to be getting a little worse. But really, I'm doing very well with the Parkinson's. I could be a lot worse than that, so I'm very grateful. I'm weaker. My pulse is very irregular some days. I walk with the walker, and I wear the hosiery that helps the swelling of the legs, which costs $300. Anyway, it would be a big help to me and my family. My girls are helping to pay for my care there at Redwood Heights right now. And I'm sure if you have children who are in their 50s to 60s, that you wouldn't want them to have to support you. So I would really appreciate being able to get on Medicare. But if I can't, I'll make it.
Thank you so much. Any questions? Representative Gomberg looks like
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to thank our guests for being with us today. And I also wanted to mention that I'm glad you came over to the beach. Our beaches are a lot better than Arizona. My question for you is this. You've been in this facility for a while, and you're leaders in your community. In a few moments, we're going to hear from the Long-Term Ombudsman Program. Are you familiar with that program?
Oh. We've had the ombudsman come.
And if you could just share with us, what's your thoughts, your reaction? What do you think of these folks?
Well, I think the lady we have now, I don't remember her name, but I think she really tries to be there and be on the ball for us and help us.
All right. Thank you so much.
We've actually had extremely good working relationship with the ombudsman's office. And some of their volunteers would just attend our council meetings and be part of the framework of the community, and very strong advocacy. We've had a really good, positive relationship with them.
Glad to hear that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the Ombudsman's Office does great work, but it's interesting to hear from the other point of view sometimes.
Absolutely. I'm glad you asked that question. Any further questions? Thank you all so much for coming. We wish you well. We're glad you're in Salem instead of Arizona. We're happy for you, too.
And we're providing lots of sun now.
Yes. Doing the best we can. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mike.
You bet.
Now we are indeed going to hear from our long-term care ombudsman, Mary Jaeger, Dan Dunham, and Claudia Kyle.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Don't see Claudia.
Maybe it was here.
Just leave it alone.
Good afternoon. I'm Mary, the long-term care ombudsman.
Wait a minute. Wait. Sorry.
I'm from Roxanne Hazen. It is here from the Four Counties Bill.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought she was in the same group. Okay, sure. Can hold and stay right there. Roxanne? Thank you, Roxanne. I'm sorry. I thought you were in with... it showed that you were with Mike, so that's why I was confused.
And I get to be... hello, Chair Tomei and representatives. I also get to sit with Mary once a month with the Malt Crack meeting to meet Medicaid long-term care assessment. I am an adult foster home provider here in Oregon. I've been a provider now for 18 years, working with the state and with my residents in my home. I have two adult foster homes now, and I have five residents in each home. And back to David for a moment. I had my father once for 9 months until he passed away in my adult foster home. With the adult foster home providers, we can take care of our own relative, like my father, as a sixth resident. And I bow down to every provider that takes care of their family member, because taking care of my father was like taking care of all of the other five residents in my home. I was like taking care of five plus five. And it's they need you so much more, and you just give. That was my feeling when David was speaking. I am a level 2 home, and I take care of people with up to 3 full dependencies that they can't get to the bathroom or take care of themselves in those situations, that they need help feeding them, they need help dressing, they need help getting up out of bed and transferring. Those kind of dependencies. I also get exceptions when somebody gets towards like the hospice level, that they can be past 3 full dependencies. And I get those exceptions with my licensors with the state. I was introduced to adult foster care in Portland in 1993. I was a kindergarten teacher, and the ones who introduced it to me were 2 of the parents in my class of the children, and one of them was a geriatrics doctor.
Doesn't she smile like a kindergarten teacher?
I was born with a smile. It just doesn't go away. And so I really got interested in it then. It was so much more me. I love the kindergarten, but I also bring it into my elder care, into my adult foster home. I do the kindergarten work with my... No, I do the same kind of things with the residents that I have, like, so a lot, especially with dementia, with the Alzheimer's and things. We bake bread. We do watercolor painting. I work with them with clay. I work with them with scrapbooking. I give them a life, and summers are great because we can sit out on the deck with the sunshine and enjoy it out there on the tables. And in the winter also, it's nice to have the warming of the bread and the baking of their own little loaf, and then get to have it with some butter on it. That's a great thing about the combination of my experience with both. So after I was introduced to adult foster care, I lived in No-Tie and took care of a diabetic in home while I was getting ready to be an adult foster home provider. That was my main goal. And then I got to find my own special home, and that was in Cottage Grove. And I found the home, and that was it. And I named it Nathaniel Home Care. Nathaniel means God gave. Natan is God. Natan is gave in Hebrew, and El is God. Hu Natan li habaita lavod im anashim. He gave me this home to serve mankind. This home and the home and the care of the work I do is to be able to get this home to those people. I am there to serve them. I take care of them. This becomes their home, and they get to be part of our family. This gives them an option to live in a home-like setting and have 24/7 care. I take care of people with many needs, from Alzheimer's to Hoyer lifting to ostomy bags to post-stroke patients and mental health problems, some mental health residents as well. So I get senior disabled services, adults, plus sometimes I can get okay through one licensor to the other to have the mental health as well. And I really specialize in hospice. I love to take care of people at the end of their life stages and to help their families get through the process of letting it go and getting them to come in and be there for them when they need them most. My typical residents are with me about 3 years. I've had them up to 7.5 years. But they don't come in for very short a time. Sometimes they come in and they look like they're going to live maybe about 3 months. And if they're fighting, I fight with them. They want to still be here, I go for it. And I try to do, usually they'll come in if they're like looking at a 3-month stage of life left because of their diabetes or something. I'll work with them quickly and help to learn all their needs. Sometimes they have to go to the hospital every 3 weeks to the emergency room. By the time I get used to them in 3-4 months, we're going about every 6 months to the emergency room. This is a really good, cost-effective system for Oregon, and that's something to say about what we have here in Oregon with the community-based care. And I feel that the long-term care community board and the community-based care in philosophy of Oregon is very outstanding. Thank you.
Thank you. I think you were speaking of yourself. It sounds like you indeed are outstanding. My mother-in-law was in a foster home the last 5 years of her life, and it was similar to this. And it was a wonderful experience. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any quick questions? Representative Whitsitt.
I was just wondering if maybe some other member of the panel could compare the cost of foster home per capita to being placed in a larger institution.
We'd like to defer to our colleague, Mike McCormick.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Roxanne. Thank you.
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, if I recall the numbers correctly, community-based care is 71% less expensive than institutional care, and in-home care is 79% less expensive than institutional care.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Mike. Okay. Mary. Welcome.
So thank you. For the record, I'm Mary Yeager, the long-term care ombudsman, and I was supposed to have two volunteers with me, but one had to leave, so you get the opportunity to spend some time with Dan Dunham, who's an ombudsman volunteer in Benton County and also serves on the advisory committee for the ombudsman program. You may if any of you are Oregon State fans, you'll recognize his name, his voice, from the football game. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Dan, would you like to start?
Certainly.
And does everybody here know what this program is? Everybody knows? Okay, terrific. Thank you.
Chair Tomei and members, my name is Dan Dunham. I am from Benton County. I'm an 8-year long-term care ombudsman. I currently serve 6 facilities in Benton County, including a foster home, 5 foster homes, let me get my numbers right, 3 foster homes, a nursing home, a memory care facility, and an assisted living facility. I want to share with you some of the kind of the dark side of long-term care, as seen by me as an ombudsman and by residents who report problems to me. About a month ago, I sat in as I was invited to sit in, as we often are, and we don't attend resident council meetings in our facilities unless we're invited. But here are some of the things that came up in that resident council meeting, some of which we've been able to resolve in the month that has passed. Call lights taking up to 30 minutes to be responded to. Who is the activity director? Why don't we have more activities? Housekeeping, very perfunctory. No substitutes are ever provided if someone's sick in that function. The night shift is a ghost. We never see them. Someone was in my room at 10:30 last night sitting at my computer, one of the staff members. We have little privacy in our own rooms. There's little knocking or asking before entry. We don't get to know who's on duty. The posting is not clear to us. Now, those may sound rather harsh, and they are. Those are of great concern to us. And every one of those issues has been followed through on by me personally to see that something is happening with it. And in most cases, the resolutions have been affected. I am a person who takes this very seriously. I have for these years. I don't have a lot of complaints because people know that they're going to get some help if that ombudsman is on the job. I get calls very late at night and very early in the morning. I try to go to the facility that same day or no later than the next day. I get calls from the state office who have received an 800 call from someone asking for help at a facility that does not have an ombudsman, and I'm often assigned to go as a special assignment to those. So it's not all roses. And I think our role is to improve the situation that's there. But let me tell you a couple other things that concern me. Because if you want to know down deep into what this program is about and what we do, here are some of my concerns observed over these years. The staffing ratios are too thin. The law requires certain numbers against certain populations of people. There are too few people in these facilities, in my view. There is no way that 6 or 7 people during the day can take care of 75 people, 40% of whom have early onset dementia, Alzheimer's. That is a fact in more than a few facilities in the state. You've already heard words to that effect earlier on by other presenters here today. Costs have nearly doubled in the last decade that I've been working as an ombudsman. I think if there's one huge issue for the state of Oregon, for the government of this country, for local communities, it is how in the world are we going to pay for long-term care? It's getting ahead of us. It's getting ahead of us pretty rapidly. One of the things that's the best thing about this program, about long-term care, is the quality of the administration generally. The fact that this is pretty much a private sector, it's a privately owned enterprise with very few nonprofit enterprises involved, that part of it I think goes pretty well. But it's a whole matter of making a profit. And if you add one staff member, somebody's got to pay for that. And those costs go to the residents. And if 25% of those residents are on Medicaid, the other 75% are private pay are going to pick up those costs. So the costs go up, and they go up just about every month for some people. I could go on. I'm not going to, because I don't want to make it sound like this is all black. It's not. It's a great system, but there are big holes in it. And one of the things we need is legislation that increases the number of staff in a facility against the number of beds. Somebody's going to have to pay for that, but it's essential. Another aspect of the staff issue is that all of the staff in long-term care, including those in memory care facilities who have not had additional training in dealing with people with Alzheimer's and other dementia types, and there are 8 or 9 other kinds of dementia, need training. Not all of them have it. The member care unit that I am assigned to in Corvallis just in the last 2 months took its entire staff to an extensive training program, and they were already pretty well trained. It's a good facility. I have no complaints there. I haven't had for a couple of years because it's a good privately owned, pretty well staffed place, but with really good training that is not uniform across the facilities, at least that I'm involved with. I have agreed, by the way, to take on another facility later this month, which has another 65 beds. It's a facility I used to be the ombudsman for, and I know it's in trouble right now. The numbers in some of these facilities are down. You've heard why. It's cheaper to stay at home. People are delaying coming into long-term care. They can't afford it. So it drives the cost, the value of their home and their resources down to the point where they get on Medicaid. Government steps in. This is not going to end. It's going to continue. So we need to get our heads around it and get something done. I'll be glad to answer questions when Mary finishes if you have any time and wish to. I don't mean, again, to be too negative about all of this, but I want you to understand it's not all beautiful. There are big holes in this thing, not just in any one level. One of the strong pieces of it is the ombudsman program. I am totally convinced that if we weren't there, there'd be a lot more stuff going on that you don't want to know about.
Thank you. I appreciate hearing that. So that brings up a question. I'm sure we have other questions. What proportion of long-term facilities have ombudsmen?
Chair Tomei and committee members, our volunteers, and I believe you got that
the pieces I sent in advance. Our volunteers are able to get to a wide variety of the assisted living, adult foster home, residential, and nursing facilities. But if we were to put all the numbers together, I would put it at about 64-65% in total. I mean, you'll see on that list, we get to almost all of the nursing homes, right, 97%,
mm-hmm.
90% of the assisted living, and 60% of the adult foster homes. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a volunteer in each of those buildings. Some people, like Dan, will go to multiple buildings because we don't have a volunteer for each. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Does that help? Okay.
So my next question would be, how often does a volunteer visit one of these facilities?
I'm visiting at least once a week and usually twice to each facility.
Okay.
I try to get in. Our minimum requirement or ask, I guess, of the office is 4 hours a week. And most of us, my average monthly hours are in the range of 20 to 25, just with these few facilities that I have. I've had as many as 11 facilities at any one time. We only have two ombudsmen in Benton County. We're recruiting heavily. And it's hard. It's a hard recruit. There's an intensive training program, a full week, 40-hour, just like a class in college. There's a visit to a facility to be sure that's really what you want to do with an already certified ombudsman. We are known as COs, certified ombudsman. I didn't bring my badge, but we carry a picture badge. We can't enter a facility without that on. And one of the issues in a facility, by the way, if you visit one and you see somebody walking around that looks like they're a staff member and they don't have a badge on, you're compelled, I am compelled, and you should be too as an interested visitor, who are you? Because unless you have a badge on or a visitor's badge, you have no business in that building. One of the things we're concerned about is their safety. And we've had robberies, we've had break-ins, there's things that happen. And a lot of the security there has to do with controlled entries. Most of them have a push button of some kind and some kind of sign-in or awareness situation of who's coming in. I have to tell somebody, some official in the building when I'm walking in that I'm there, even though I've been going to these places for years. But I have to contact either the administrator or some other staff member. And we have to wear a badge. It's required.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you for coming. I love this program. I really appreciate what you're doing all as a volunteer. Aside from the training, what kind of coordination do you have with the office? Do you get together with other COs? You know, is there either for training, share stories, celebration, reward?
All of that. And we meet monthly by district. We have a number of districts. Each of our deputies is assigned to one or more of those districts. We have district training, upgrading training sessions every month. They last 2 or 3 hours, depending on the topics. Our local recruitment and screening committees are beginning to get in place now to provide some kind of reward type of deal for the ombudsman in their district, recognition, thank you dessert, something like that. We just completed a statewide training event. We had about 150 people there. About two-thirds to three-fourths of all of our ombudsmen were able to make it in. We just completed that this last week. It was terrific. We heard from some wonderful speakers. We had some good training events, upgraded some of our stuff on things like elder abuse, the SMP program, which some of us are certified in also, some of us are not, including myself. And I want to say something about one of the previous speakers. My biggest complaint, by the way, that I get in a facility is food. And a lot of it's because these elderly ladies would love to get their hands on that kitchen because the food has never been like it was when they were cooking. And food is a problem. And it clearly is. There's a lot of reasons for that besides costs and so on.
I have a question.
Oh, Representative Whitsitt.
Is there a reason why we can't allow some of the women to cook who want to cook?
Yeah. They have to be certified. I mean, it has to be a person who holds a food handler's license, just like with Stone Soup. People that handle food have to have a state food handler's license. and they have to be a practiced cook. They can send in their recipes to the kitchen, mm-hmm. and sometimes those will be, you know, recipes from the home cookbook.
Follow up. Maybe we should make it easier with rulemaking or something to allow, because a lot of elderly women are excellent cooks, to allow them to participate in their own homes cooking.
I won't comment on that. I don't want to get into it.
Representative Gilliam, I think I've missed you, and I apologize.
I've missed you, too.
Thank
you, Madam Chair. Dan, I'm glad you came. I appreciated it, your story. Yeah, you were kind of harsh, and you used the word, you take it very seriously, but I sense another way of saying that in your case is that you care very much, which is why you do it. Would you just say a word either about why you started or what keeps you doing this besides the chance to work with Mary?
You use the word my wife uses, which is that I care. I care too much, she says sometimes. We brought three of my wife's family members or close family friends to Oregon to live and die. And they all lived and died in long-term care. My two parents, who moved earlier to Idaho, lived and died in assisted living, long-term care. With my mother-in-law and my mother-in-law's best friend, who both came here to live and die. They didn't come here to die, they just did once they got here. I spent a lot of time in the facilities, the nursing home, the assisted living, and that's why I just thought, why not? There was a little ad in our local paper saying they were looking for ombudsman. I didn't know anything about it, but I thought, sounds interesting, so I went to the interview. I did an application, which is screened by two or three people. It's sent back to our local committee. They invite you in and interview you. They make a recommendation that you can go through the training, and the rest is, as they say, a little bit of history. The training was intense. I attended. There were like 12 people in our class in Albany 8 years ago. Five of us completed. That's how tough it is. Mm-hmm. They just dropped out. They said, I can't do this. It's too much. It's a big book. It's a thick. I still have it. Once in a while, I look at it. I probably should look at it more than I do. But we have the monthly training, and our deputies are always come with a new topic or some upgrading thing. But you mentioned something else, representing Kenny Geyer. We share what's an issue that we're dealing with around the table. There's like in the two groups, my group from Lynn Benton and the Salem area group meet together. Mm. And we go around the table. There's probably 12 or 14 people, 12 people anyway in the room. And everybody has something that they've been working on, from as simple as a food issue to somebody being given a move-out notice for not good reason. You can't be kicked out of one of these places without 30 days notice. That's the state law. And we almost always get involved in those. We almost always get involved in guardianship issues because we are in the line of clearance for guardianships. And we are required to go, it's almost like being a court advocate, to the resident and ask them if they want the guardianship. That's not too easy to do with people who have limited or have mental problems, mental health problems, and so we'll sit with another person, usually a staff member at that facility, to be sure that they understand. Mm-hmm. They can often speak to them better than I can, because that's what they're supposed to be trained to do, although some of that training is kind of not so great. But we have a lot of things we do, but mostly it's the visits, saying hello. One of the things that I've found to be the most rewarding is that the men in these facilities love to have a man come to talk mm-hmm. to them. Mm-hmm. And if you have men in your church who want to do a service, mm-hmm. go visit the men in mm-hmm. these facilities, because they're lonesome. They don't have other men, very many other men to talk to. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the most rewarding things to me. And we'll talk about just about anything, including some of the men in the mental in Regent Court. They, I know some of their background because they list the information on their door, and I'll pick up something from that, and it's usually something way back in their history, and we'll talk about it. There was a lady from my home country down in Lakeview who was known, I knew her well, and she was didn't remember anything except that her husband was a cowboy. Oh. And I was a cowboy one time, and we talked cowboys, and we talked cattle. And that she remembered. And she would smile, and then I would say, I'll see you later. Oh, and she said, and who are you? You do what you do.
Representative Gumbert.
Good, thank you.
Did you have a question?
I thought Representative Gumbert did. No? Okay, Representative Kennegar.
Thank you. And how many people do you have that speak other languages or from other cultures or ethnicities? How much are you able to meet the need of Latinos and other racial groups?
In the Portland area, we, of course, have a greater number, and in the Woodburn area with Hispanic speakers. I don't know that more than a handful of our ombudsmen are multilingual, but efforts are being made to overcome that issue, to deal with it, and to recruit from that population, from those populations, Spanish speakers especially, and other Asians, speakers from the Portland metro area. I don't know how well that's going, but I know our coordinator of volunteers, she's death on recruitment. I mean, she just goes after it, and if they're there to be found, Gretchen will find them and get them. And the RNS committees, the recruitment screening committees in our communities, in our districts, four or five of those are really, really active, and it's beginning to show a little bit, but not enough at this point.
Thank you so much for coming today. We've heard from Mary, and we've heard from other people about the ombudsman program. But this is the first time we've heard from a volunteer, that I can remember. I really appreciate you coming.
It's my pleasure.
We certainly appreciate the work that you're doing in this program.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we appreciate your support. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you
for having us.
I'll share your appreciation with my colleagues.
Oh, please do. Please do. And if any of them want to come and visit with us, we'd love to have a hearing and have them come
Indeed.
And tell us their stories.
Thank you.
Thank you all who came here today. And we didn't hear from all of you, but from those we did hear from, thank you so much for sharing your stories with you. Thank you, Mike, and other people. Thank you, and thank you, committee, for staying. I know some people had to leave. And with that, I will close the Human Services Committee and